tračimo pa gotam, ki je okrej se svi gnusi gore. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 Om namo bhagavate
Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, the Samam Bonam. Chapter 58, Krishna marries five princesses, text 41. Shri Raju Vacha, Kyonyaste Biyadyo Nata,
Kyonyaste Biyadyo Nata.
Kanyavara Ihipsata
Kunaika
Damna Yasyange Shri Vishyati Anapayani Shri Raju Vacha Konyaste Pyadiko Nata
Konyaste Pyadiko Nata
Kanyavara Ihipsataha
Kanyavara Ihipsataha
Kunaika Damna Yasyange
Kunaika Damna Yasyange
Shri Vasyat Yani Payani
Shri Raju Vacha
Konyaste Vyadiko Nata Kanyavara Ihipsataha Kunaika Damna Yasyange Shri Vasyat Yani Payani
Shri Raju Vacha
Yaste Vyadiko Nata
Oyaste Vyadiko Nata
Kanyavara Ihipsita
Kanyavara Ihipsita
Kanyavara Ihipsita
Kanyavara Ihipsita
Kanyavara Ihipsita Kanyavara
Ihipsita Kanyavara
Ihipsita
Vacha.
Vacha.
The king Nagnajit
said,
Ka,
who,
Anya, other,
Te,
to you, Abhyadika
superior.
Nata, O Master. Kanya,
for my daughter.
Bara,
groom.
Iha,
in this world.
Ipsita,
desirable.
Guna,
of
transcendental qualities.
Ika,
only. Damna,
who is the abode?
Yasya,
on whose?
Ange,
body.
Sri,
the
goddess of fortune.
Vasati,
resides.
Anapayani,
never leaving.
Translation
and purports by the followers of this divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The king said, O my lord, who could be a better husband for my daughter than you, the exclusive abode of all transcendental qualities? On your body the goddess of fortune herself resides, never leaving you for any reason. Text 42. But to ascertain the proper husband for my daughter, O chief of the Satvatars, we previously set a condition to test the prowess of her suitors. Purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the king's actual purpose in setting up the test was to obtain Sri Krishna as his son-in-law, since only he could subdue the bulls. Without such a test, it would have been difficult for Nagnajit to refuse the many apparent qualified princes and kings who came to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. Om Jnana Chananandasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Guru Namaha Vancha Kalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I was born in the darkest of ignorance, but my eyes were opened by my spiritual master, who came to me with the torch of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So you have to forgive me, I'm a little sick today. A little bit of a head cold. Still, I pray to Sri Radha Vallabhar and the lotus feet of all the assembled Vaishnavas that I can speak something appropriate, pleasing to Krishna and pleasing to his devotees. So here the situation is that Sri Krishna is beginning to expand his dynasty by acquiring wives. And this particular chapter acquires five princesses after marrying Rukmini previously. He's now five more princesses. And this particular pastime here is the pastime where he subdues seven bulls, in order to obtain his princess, his wife, by the name of what's the name of this princess? Nagnajiti.
She's got another name too.
Nagnajiti, that would make sense, since she's the daughter of Nagnajit. Anyway, the situation is that King Nagnajit, he has set up a task. Actually, he says to Krishna, I would willingly give you my daughter straight up, but previously I have established this test that must be obtained, that must be passed in order for me to be able to give away my daughter in marriage. And that test is that one must enter the ring with seven bulls who are particularly aggressive and uncontrolled, untamed. And one must tame those bulls by putting a ring through their nose. And the fact is, many, because this daughter of King Nagnajit is so desirable because of her good qualities and beauty, many young princes and kings have attempted this task, but have had their limbs smashed and broken and gone away also downcast because they couldn't defeat the bulls. So Krishna has turned up, and the king is saying to Krishna, "My lord, who could be a better husband for my daughter than you, the exclusive abode of all transcendental qualities?" So this is actually the nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is that he has all personal qualities in complete fullness. Therefore, he is the Supreme Person. He has the six opulences in full. Complete wealth, complete strength, complete fame, knowledge, renunciation, and beauty are all possessed by Krishna in full. And any attractive features we see and we experience in dealing with people, those are, you could say that the qualities and the attractive features we experience in our day-to-day interpersonal relations are but a spark of the splendor of Krishna's personal qualities. And this is actually, because a person is the supreme experience you can have in this world. The supreme experience you have is not relating to some dull matter, but rather relating to another person. So in the supreme sense, in the transcendental sense, the supreme experience we can have of the absolute truth is relating to the personality of Godhead, who is possessed of all transcendental qualities. And so charming are these qualities that Krishna is known as the all-attractive. In fact, Prabhupada often translated Krishna as the all-attractive. And this is the ultimate feature of the personality of Godhead, of God. Many other traditions and other religions, they will say that it's important to fear God, and one must obey, otherwise there are these consequences. And even Bhagavatam says that the wind is blowing, the sun is shining, the planets are remaining in their orbits, etc., things like that. The cosmos is going on in an orderly way out of fear of the personality of Godhead. And the Christians will say, fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. But, fear is motivating. Certainly fear, if Gopal Guru establishes a rule in the temple to keep things orderly and then puts a consequence attached to that, that keeps things in place. It's certainly a way to manage things. But the personality of Godhead is not simply a dry, dictatorial autocrat, trying to control everything and keep everybody in their place or else. No, Krishna has much better things to do with his time. And it's in fact just in the material world, where the souls are rather rebellious, that he needs such, he needs to exercise such fearful influence. But in the spiritual world, where Krishna is mainly concerned with the spiritual world, the material world is a part of his energy that he sets aside for the conditioned souls, for the souls that want to enjoy separately, and they can enter into that world and pretend so many things. And therefore, in this world, just to keep things in a little bit in order, so the conditioned and souls don't kill one another, create some laws, create some punishment, some cause and effect. No, but actually Krishna is enjoying in this spiritual world as the all-attractive Supreme Person. And the devotees and the Lord are experiencing rasa through their loving exchange with one another. And this is the ultimate feature, and this is what Prabhupada gave us, which is so wonderful, is this understanding of God as the all-attractive Supreme Being, the Supreme Enjoyer. Because ultimately, we, more than moving by fear, more than making decisions and calculating our movements through life based on fear, the more powerful principle that we govern, that governs our life, is our attractions. An attraction, by definition, is a kind of potency that just draws you willingly towards the attractive object. So this is actually the highest quality of the personality of Godhead. That's why Krishna, or the all-attractive Supreme Being, is the highest, the original, and the highest form of Godhead. Because he is most attractive. His power to attract the living entities is so powerful. And therefore he is the Supreme. He doesn't have to use other methods of motivation. Simply, you're drawn to him because he is so beautiful. And we can experience that in the holy name. The name is non-different from the named. Chanting Hare Krishna, the more we chant, the more we fall in love with the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, with the sound, Krishna, Rama, and Hari. And the more we meditate on that sound, the more depth is revealed in the mantra. And the more depth that mantra takes on for us, that when we chant it, we immediately, what follows the name, the form, qualities and pastimes, we begin to get to know Krishna through his holy name. And we become charmed. And therefore our attractions for things of this mundane world fall away. So he's the abode of all transcendental qualities. On your body, the goddess of fortune herself resides, never leaving for any reason. So generally in this world, the materialists, sometimes even the devotees, they like to get some wealth, chase fortune, the glitter of gold and money, and the things that money can buy, fortune. But it's said that the fortune in this world is very flickering. Very flickering. Because everybody wants it, so they're all fighting over it. But also it just tends to come and go. And, you could think you're building up a very secure empire for yourself, financially or economically. And then some, especially these days, because you can work hard, and what are you doing? You're accumulating numbers in a computer. Prabhupada makes this point, there's no gold standardization. Apparently a dollar is supposed to be worth a certain amount of gold. And, if you really wanted to, you could say, okay, I'm going to give my money, give me the gold, But, as Prabhupada says, they're just printing money as they need it. There's no gold standardization. So all the money you're working for is simply numbers sitting in some, computer mainframe somewhere. At any time, theoretically, the computer could crash. Do you remember how much? I had $1 million. sometimes that happens, right? Who's ever opened their internet banking and think and there's another $10,000 in there or something? Or there's an extra zero on the end. You thought you had $20,000, but it's $200,000. You go, that's good. But then, of course, the next day they send you an email saying, "We're sorry, we made a mistake. We have now corrected it." So the point is the desire to create, to generate, or to draw wealth to us, and to maintain it, is a very unstable endeavor. Very easily, you know, human society spend so much time building big buildings, accumulating wealth, artworks, and then there's like a big world war and some bomb comes and blows it up. And like this, the wealth in this world is flickering. You know, the stories of people who, you know, they started off as paupers, became rich through some business enterprise, then they lost everything and went bankrupt, and then again they created wealth for themselves. Or great kings who, you know, had a lot of money, but the sons squandered it and died in poverty. Yeah, especially kings, you know, they're always fighting. Some kings trying to take away your wealth. So, the goddess of fortune, flickering in this world. She doesn't generally stay with people for very long. Fickle. But, what does this verse say? That on the chest of Lord Krishna, and it's particularly in his Narayan form, the goddess of fortune herself resides, never leaving for any reason. In the Bhagavatam it says that, you know, the goddess of fortune resides on the chest of Lord Narayan, even though he doesn't even care for her. Normally women, they like to feel that they're cherished by their husband. But, you know, I think even Narayan says himself, yeah, she resides and she's very attached to her position on my chest, even though I'm not attached in any way. Because she's so enchanted and charmed by the transcendental qualities of the Lord. Because he's so attractive. It's such a wonderful association. She doesn't wish for anything more. And then King Nagnajit continues, but to ascertain the proper husband for my daughter, O chief of the Satvatars, we previously set a condition to test the prowess of her suitors. So he's talking about he's going to reveal what this test is. And according to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the king's actual purpose in setting up the test was to obtain Sri Krishna as his son-in-law, since only he could subdue the bulls. Without such a test, it would have been difficult for Nagnajit to refuse many apparently qualified princes and kings who came to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. You know, so she is desirable as a wife for the royal order. And you know, King Nagnajit wanted to give her to Krishna. So he thought, how can I do that and at the same time, you know, be diplomatic so I don't have to say no sorry, no sorry, no sorry to all the kings of saying, what about me? So he devised this test that he knew only Krishna could pass. And a similar thing happened with Draupadi. And King Drupad wanted to marry her to Arjuna and no one else. So he devised a test whereby one would have to string a bow, and that in itself was a hard thing to do because it was a pretty powerful bow. And many kings, they tried to just string the bow, and the bow ended up just throwing them back, and they couldn't do it, you know, because you got to bend the bow, and then you got to hold it with one hand and put the string on. Similar, Lord Ramachandra did that as well. Had to string the bow. So it was a very difficult thing to do, and only very few kings could actually even do string the bow. And then what you had to do is, I think there was a pot of water on the ground, and you could only look into the reflection of the pot of water, and then on a tall post there was a spinning wheel, a cartwheel, spinning, you know, with all its spokes, and then sitting above the cartwheel was a false fish, and you had to, looking in the reflection, first you had to string the bow, and then looking in the reflection in the pot, you had to shoot an arrow through the spinning wheel and pierce the eye of the fish. It's a very difficult task. And of course, only Arjuna could do it. Of course, Krishna could have done it, but you know, it wasn't expected that Krishna would attend. So, you know, at that time, the Pandavas, they'd just escaped from destruction in the house of Lak. which Duryodhan devised to burn them to death. But actually, they dug a tunnel out and escaped into the forest. So they were in exile, and they were traveling actually as brahmanas, in disguise as brahmanas. Anyway, they heard about this contest, and they said, let's go along, dressed up as brahmanas. So they went to the arena, and all the kings tried to do it, and they all failed. And then Arjuna said, I'm going to give it a go. So he stepped out as a brahmin, and everybody was like, what is this? Brahmin, he doesn't look like a brahmin actually, because he's extremely muscular. Normally brahmins are skinny and kind of, nerdy. in terms of their physical physique, they're not warriors. They're intellectuals. They work with their brain rather than their brawn. Anyway, so Arjuna stepped down and said, who is this brahmana? But very easily he strung the bow and completed the task. And everybody was extremely surprised. And then some of the kings became very angry and began to attack. So Bhima and Arjuna beat them all off. And anyway, eventually it was revealed, King Duryodhan saw this and he asked one of his servants to follow them back, because they beat off all the kings. And I said, this is very unusual behavior for brahmanas. So they went back to their, as their five brothers, because there's five brahmanas working together, as they went back to their hut where they were staying, he said, follow them. So what actually happened, this is how Draupadi got married all five Pandavas, because Arjuna wanted to give her to Yudhisthira, wasn't it? I believe that was the case. Anyway, they turned up and they went in, and Queen Kunti was there. And Arjuna said, guess what, Mum? Guess what we did today? Guess what we won in charity? And she said, whatever it is, just divide it evenly among yourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mum, we just won a princess. But she couldn't go back on her word, because her word of honour was so important. So that's how the Pandavas married married Draupadi. And then they were lying down that night to speak. There were five Pandavas in a row, and then Draupadi crossways at their feet. And when they were lying down, the spy was there. Duryodhan's spy was there listening, and they were talking about, like battles and bows and fights they'd had and stuff like that. And then the spy was thinking, yeah, these are not brahmanas. And he took the message back to Duryodhan, and it was confirmed that these are actually the five Pandavas returned from their hiding. Anyway, so it's not an uncommon thing that some king will set a great test that only a very great personality can pass. So King Nagnajit set such a test. Seven wild bulls, impossible to tame, O hero, they have defeated many princes, breaking their limbs. If you can subdue them, O descendant of Yadu, you will certainly be an appropriate bridegroom for my daughter, O lord of Sri. Who is Sri? Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune. Upon hearing these terms, the Lord tightened his clothing, expanded himself into seven forms. How about that? Seven forms. And easily subdued the bulls. See, Bhagavatam doesn't even go into much of the detail. He just expanded himself into seven forms and very easily subdued the bulls. No problem. Purport. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, Lord Krishna expanded himself into seven forms not only to playfully defeat the seven bulls, but also to show the princess Satya, that's her name, Satya, that she would not have to compete with his other queens, since he would enjoy all of them simultaneously. Very interesting. Very interesting point. Because Krishna was very popular with the ladies. And anybody, any social prophet could probably understand that Krishna would have more than one wife, many wives. Perhaps they couldn't guess how many. 16,108. So Satya might have been thinking, you know, Krishna is so wonderful. Imagine if Krishna was my husband, that would be, that'd be nectar. But we'll have to share him with so many co-wives. That wouldn't be so nectar. So she had that doubt in her mind. So Krishna showed, this is what Srila Sridhar Swami says, that Krishna expanded himself into seven forms to show that, look, it's no problem for me to expand myself. And therefore, you will have your own form of myself as your husband. That all to yourself. So, you know, sometimes as devotees, we might think, you know, Krishna is a limited commodity. Huh? Prema Bhakti is a limited commodity. The positions in the spiritual world are already filled. You know, what if it gets filled up and I don't get to get there? Or even more practically, you know, you're thinking, there's only so much mercy to go around. And therefore, sometimes when devotees, you know, see other devotees performing service very nicely, we begin to get a little bit envious, thinking, oh, he's performing very nice service for Krishna. That means he's going to get more attention and mercy from Krishna than me. Therefore, I'm envious. It's a subtle psychology. That's actually what's going on. It's ego, false ego. We're thinking, you know, like, the person's getting, making advancement. And, you know, any time a conditioned soul sees another conditioned soul getting, doing well, this kind of burning in the heart happens, you know. That's all right, but what about me? And you know, because nobody wants to, you know, everybody wants to feel themselves the controller and the enjoyer. And when we see other people doing that more effectively, we get envious. And it's very problematic, actually. Prabhupada said that envy is actually indirect appreciation. Because what you're seeing is some excellent quality or some excellent activity of your fellow devotee. And you're appreciating that. But it's a begrudging appreciation. Because you're thinking, oh, they're doing actually well, but what about me? So, it's not actually the case that there's any scarcity of Krishna. There's no scarcity of mercy. Krishna is demonstrating that to us here. Krishna is unlimited, and he can have unlimited relationships with unlimited devotees. It's actually a fact that you are not the only knower of the field of your body. It's actually a fact. And you don't even know your field perfectly. There is another knower within all bodies. Both indirectly and directly. The Supreme Personality of Godhead knows all creation and knows all fields. So all the activities of your mind, all your emotions, all your intellectual activities, all your physical activities, all the pains and pleasures of your body that you know, Krishna also knows. And he knows them intimately. He knows what's inside everyone's pocket. He knows what's under every rock. He knows what's inside everybody's suitcase. He knows the entire creation perfectly, inside and out. And he knows your heart perfectly. And he's there with you, sensing your desires, like one can sense the aroma of a flower by being near to it. And therefore, you know, the super soul for the conditioned soul is acting in a rather passive state, you know, sitting in the background humbly. And we're going, hey, check this out. Hey, check that out. Wow, and developing desires and developing aspirations in relation to the sense objects we come in contact with. And those aspirations have been sensed by the super soul. He's going, okay, sure. And then what appears in your mind, a plan. I know how I achieve my desire. Where is that plan coming from? Yeah. From me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Very interesting point. That all your knowledge how to execute things, that's coming from the super soul. How does a small spider, wanders around once he gets his string, how does he know how to build a web? Huh? The soul inside the body of a spider, the knowledge to do that is given by the super soul. So, the super soul, Krishna, knows everyone perfectly. And actually, the Krishna conscious process is to change our relationship to that super soul. To no longer, what does Prabhupada say in Bhagavad Gita? He gives the example of the two birds in one tree. One bird's just like, wow, check out all these fruits. And the super soul's just sitting there. Wow, jumps to one bunch, jumps to another bunch, eating all the fruits, nibbling away, enjoying. Now the bird's just accompanying. And it's so fascinating. And it's like us in the material world. They're so fascinated by all the fruits and opportunities for enjoyment. And the super souls are simply accompanying us. We said, no, what is actually supposed to happen is that bird eventually realizes, hey, anyway, I've been chomping on these fruits for flaming lifetimes, and I'm still not satisfied. And then he turns to the super soul. Let's have a relationship. Huh? And through that, acknowledging the super soul, building that, again, developing that relationship, awakening that relationship with the super soul, real satisfaction is obtained. And Krishna begins to give a different type of knowledge. What is that knowledge? To one dedicated to serving me with love, I give the intelligence by which he can come to me. And then they both birds fly away from the tree of the material world together. So this is one name for Krishna is Surit. Dear friend, most intimate friend within your heart. Following you through so many abominable species of life, through so many activities of self-centered sense gratification. In your heart, right now. Right now he's there. You're thinking, and the mind's going here and there, and over so many things. Krishna's there. He knows what you're going through. We're just unconscious of his presence. So, in one sense, and he's within all of our bodies. In each body, the super soul is there, accompanying the individual soul. And Krishna's not like a person of the material world who can only do a few things at once. like sometimes a receptionist. Everybody knows that what a great job being a receptionist is. It's like, hello, how are you? How can I? And another call, and then somebody's coming in and say, can I have some washing money? or whatever, What about this? And then the temple president's ringing you up and saying, what about those letters? Can you post this? Can you do that? And you're like, there's only a certain amount of things we can hold inside our consciousness. And for men, it's even less than women. I said women are quite good at multitasking. Men are completely hopeless. So Krishna's not like that. It's not that Krishna's so busy as the super soul in somebody else's heart that he doesn't have time to relate to you perfectly with full attention. No, Krishna's unlimited. And the really exciting thing about the Krishna conscious spiritual reality is that each of us is an individual, eternally. That means you have your own nature, your own specific flavor, your specific angle in relationship to the Absolute Truth. Your relationship with the Absolute Truth, with Krishna, is unique. And there's a unique flavor to be had there that nobody else experiences in the exact same way. It's like Krishna's like an enormous, unlimited gem with unlimited facets. Facets, when they get a gem, it's raw, and then they cut it with all different faces. And each, you can look at the face from so many, you look at the gem from so many different angles and get so many different enchanting views. Krishna is like a gem with unlimited facets. They're unlimited souls, not conditioned souls, but souls, engaging with Krishna from so many different tangles and so many different relationships. And he's got time for all of them. Krishna's experience of time is not 24 hours in a day bus. It's not like that. Krishna has unlimited time and attention for everyone. So we should not be afraid that there is a scarcity of mercy or a scarcity of Krishna conscious nectar to be had. And therefore, if somebody else is getting a lot of mercy, we feel envious. No, we should feel the proper attitude, as Prabhupada said, when you feel envy, is to recognize this is indirect appreciation. Therefore, let me directly appreciate. Let me just appreciate directly. Wow, that's really great what you're doing. And actually, a practical tip is if you actually, rather than just do it in your mind like some sort of mental thing that you do, it's even more powerful in dissolving that envy, and it's actually good for building the relationship, strengthening a relationship, making an investment into the emotional bank account with that particular person. If you actually think, you know, some envy comes up and you say, anyway, I'm a devotee, so I'm going to conduct my mind in a devotional way. And you think, okay, so this envy is indirect appreciation. Prabhupada teaches us that. So what am I actually appreciating about that person? And then go to that person and say, hey, I really appreciate this quality that you're displaying, or this activity you're doing with such excellence. And the person will think, wow, that's really nice. Thank you so much. And that exchange will completely dissipate the envy, because you recognize that person. They're sincere devotee. I should support them in the devotional service, and they'll want to do the same to you. So a very important point. There's no scarcity of mercy. We can simply praise the devotees rather than get envious of their good qualities. Appreciate. And the fact is, so many... this world is a big place. Very big place. How many people live in Melbourne? What's the population of Melbourne? 4 million. So how many people in this room? Probably like 30 or 40 max. So what fraction? What fraction is 40 of 4 million? It's very small. Put it that way. 4 million people is a lot of people. I calculated once, if you were going to count to 1 million, going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, like that sort of pace, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. If you were going to count at that pace, it would take you 3 days without sleep to get to 1 million. 3 days without sleep to get to 1 million, counting constantly at that pace. 1 million is a big number. It's a big number. 4 million is an even bigger number. So, there's a lot of people out there that need connection with devotees and need relationships with devotees. So, there's so much that needs to be done. There's so much mercy to be had serving in Lord Chaitanya's mission, in Srila Prabhupada's mission. So much mercy. And more and more we need to become qualified to distribute that mercy, or to distribute Krishna consciousness. And we'll make such advancement by doing that. So, you know, these days I'm very happy, you know, because recently I've had some responsibility in the preaching mission. And as you get that, what you realize is that, you know, I'm not envious or kind of defensive about my service, this or that. No, I want more and more people to get involved, more and more people to help. And the more qualified they are, the better. The more sincere they are, the better. The more they can do for Krishna's pleasure and for Lord Chaitanya's mission, the better. So rather than feeling envious, you're just thinking, yeah, you just want to encourage them to make as much advancement and to be as productive and get as much mercy as they can so they can distribute that mercy. Completely different. It's taken me some time to get to that point, you know, where you're actually thinking, you know, the more the better, and the more qualified, the better. People. Yeah. It's especially those in leadership positions, they should never be thinking, you know, be insecure and thinking, well, if somebody gets really good, you know, then I'll, you know, somebody does really good service, then my position will be usurped. You know, they'll come and push me out of the way and, ah, I'm the big man. No, that's nonsense. The point is, any devotee who is showing dedication, determination, is influencing those around them in a positive Krishna conscious way, they'll never be out of work in ISKCON. What I mean by work is they'll never not have service to do. Because, you know, if you can, you know, become a preacher where you go somewhere and people become interested in Krishna consciousness and want to begin to contribute, there's unlimited scope for that. There's so many suburbs in Melbourne. In every suburb, if you look in the phone book, there's heaps and heaps of churches in every suburb. We've got one temple. So there's unlimited scope. The Loft Centre, for those who like that kind of preaching, you know, in the city kind of preaching. There's so many scope. We need many, many people who can create that type of environment, who can attract people to that type of environment and begin to engage them in devotional service so the community of devotees grows. So there's no scarcity of mercy to be had. So we should always be very happy when people advance and show good qualities and begin to get some shakti, bhakti shakti. Interesting. For those who are interested in preaching, Burujan Prabhu was talking to him when he was here, and he was talking about preaching. He was saying, actually, preaching, it's mystical. It's not simply a mundane process where you make some friendship with somebody and you convince them of some argument or some philosophy and then they take it up and then they begin practicing. No, he said, the real factor is the bhakti shakti. The bhakti shakti. He said, it's a mystical energy, it's not of this world, and it resides within the heart of the devotee. The devotee, you know, for a non-devotee, the deities, they have no significance, really. But for a devotee who has devotion, can experience Krishna through the deity because of their bhakti, because of their devotion, through the holy name. You know, when a non-devotee chants the holy name, Prabhupada says it's got no potency. In fact, it can be dangerous, like the milk touched by the lips of a serpent. But when it's chanted by a pure devotee, as much as possible, as far as possible, the chanting should be heard from the lips of a pure devotee. So the devotee who has bhakti shakti within the heart, when they chant the holy name, their activities are saturated with a certain devotion, with devotion. The determination is, you know, people sometimes mystified by the determination of a devotee. Are you guys getting paid for this? You're working so hard. Ravindra Sharup tells the story, you know. He was distributing books, and there was this guy watching him, kind of shaking his head. And he could see that, Ravindra Sharup could see that he wanted to say something. So I went up to him and tried to distribute a book, and he said, no, I'm not interested, but I just wanted to tell you something. I feel so sorry for you. Very condescending. I feel so sorry for you. At the same time, I admire you. And he said, let me explain. Okay. I admire you because you work so hard. But I also feel sorry for you because it's all for that guy. And he pointed at a picture of Prabhupada. It's all for that guy. In other words, his conception was, he's some guru, you know, that is sitting on top of the, you know, of all these slaves and servants, you know, and enjoying. and you've just been fooled by him. And you're working so hard. So in one sense, he was just mystified. You guys working so hard. He couldn't understand the determination, which is infectious actually, the enthusiasm the devotees have for Krishna and Krishna consciousness. That's infectious. It's powerful. People don't have that kind of enthusiasm for mundane things generally. Or if they do, it's just kind of stupid. I mean, to be really fired up about stamp collecting or something like that, it's foolish. It's actually foolish, you know. For the devotees, they're fired up about something. Their hearts are enthusiastic to the point where sometimes they're even zealous. But they're also heads are full of knowledge. You know, you talk to them and they go, yeah, it's because I believe, I've got such faith. No, they can say, well, you know, this is why I'm fired up, because of this philosophical reason. And, you know, it's all reasonable. People are impressed. They say, wow, your heart's full of some interesting shakti. Yeah, it's bhakti shakti. And your mind's also full of philosophy and knowledge and wisdom. And they're attracted to that. So Burujan was saying, preaching rests on this bhakti shakti. It means making it available so other person can rub shoulders with you or hear from you or whatever, contact you and taste this bhakti shakti. So that's an important point in preaching, is to create that common ground, that space where people feel comfortable enough to relate to the devotees for some period of time. And then after relating to the devotees for some period of time, it could be longer for some, shorter for others, they begin to detect there's something mystical going on with this person, with these people. The bhakti shakti begins to influence them. And they begin to desire that. And it's not of this world. The devotee's enthusiasm, the devotee's drive, the devotee's emotions are not of this world. They're not inspired by some, you know, composition of matter. They're transcendental. Lord Sauri tied up the bulls, whose pride and strength was now broken, and pulled them with ropes just as a child playfully pulls wooden toy bulls. So you can imagine little bulls with wheels on them, and the child's just pulling them around. Krishna's just pulling the bulls around. Seven of them, he's seven forms, pulling the bulls around. Tied them up, no problem. Then King Nagnajit, pleased and astonished, presented his daughter to Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead accepted the suitable bride in the proper Vedic fashion. Purport. The word Sadrisham, or Sadrisim, indicates that the lovely princess was a fitting bride for the Lord because she possessed wonderful transcendental qualities that complemented him. As Srila Jiva Goswami points out, the word Vishmita indicates that King Nagnajit was certainly astonished at the many extraordinary events suddenly taking place in his life. So Krishna's an extraordinary personality, and so therefore when he's around, extraordinary things happen. Bob Marley had this lyric in one of his songs, "Where I am, that's where it's at." So that's not really true, but but for Krishna it is true. Where he is, that's where it's at. And even the associates of Lord Chaitanya, they'd say that as well. Lord Chaitanya, where you are, that's where it's at, because your mind is Vrindavan. Where you are, that's Vrindavan. The king's wives felt the greatest ecstasy upon attaining Lord Krishna as the dear husband of the royal princess, and a mood of great festivity arose. Conch shells, horns and drums resounded, along with vocal and instrumental music and the sounds of brahmanas invoking blessings. The joyful men and women adorned themselves with fine clothing and garlands. As the dowry, powerful King Nagnajit gave 10,000 cows, 3,000 young maidservants wearing golden ornaments on their necks and bedecked in fine clothing, 9,000 elephants, 100 times as many chariots as elephants, and 100 times as many horses as chariots, and 100 times many more maidservants than horses. That's a lot. The king of Kosala, his heart melting with affection, had the bride and groom seated on their chariot and then sent them their way surrounded by a great army. So the mood of festivity, of celebration here is very nice. And Krishna consciousness, we need to have, you know, a mood of celebration. Maybe not all the time, but regularly we need to have celebration. That's very important because life can get very sort of humdrum. Devotional life shouldn't be like that. It should be a great celebration. What are we celebrating? That we are servants of Lord Krishna. We are servants of Lord Chaitanya. Advaita Acharya had this mood. You know, sometimes he'd be sitting with the devotees, taking prasadam quietly, and then he'd become overwhelmed with some ecstasy. And he'd leap up and he'd say, I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya! I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya! And I am a servant of his servants and his servants. And then he'd sit down very quietly, take his prasadam. So he was ecstatic to be a devotee, huh? And to celebrate having such a wonderful, glorious, all-attractive master. So we've got no reason not to celebrate as devotees. You should understand that philosophically. And that's a very important aspect. And of course, Bhaktiman led a very rousing kirtan this morning, and it was very all the devotees were jumping, and it was it's nice. It's kirtan is for that, for celebrating. And sometimes when people contact the kirtan and the bhakti shakti from the heart of all the devotees is flowing out into a communal pool, and everybody's jumping and smiling and chanting with such ecstasy, they're just like, wow. You don't see that in the material world. You don't see that in the material world. If people are jumping and yelling and things like that, it means they're intoxicated. Yeah, it is. It does. Like, we had a kirtan last night at the Krishna Fest at Urban Yoga, and we were just dancing around and doing what Hare Krishnas do. And some people, some people weren't actually dancing; they were sitting down and watching. But I can imagine what they were thinking. It's like, oh, these people are like really into this, you know? Because most people, you go to a club or something, and you don't start dancing immediately. You start drinking a bit or taking some intoxication. And you start to warm up, and then you start to lose your inhibitions, and then you go out on the dance floor. But devotees do that. What? 7 o'clock in the morning? It's far out. Even 4:30 in the morning. Sometimes, on a festival day, Janmashtami, normally Mangaladi's like, samsaradava naralida loka. Yeah. But on a festival day, when I first came here, last Janmashtami, I woke up in the morning and Annie Ruda came in and the temple room was packed, and it's like the whole temple room was swaying and moving back and forth, and it was just like electric energy. 4:30 in the morning. You normally don't. 4:30 in the morning after getting up from bed, people might, if they're very intoxicated and they've stayed up all night, it might be possible, but just got up first thing in the morning. Celebration like that. It's incredible. So that celebration of Krishna consciousness, very attractive to people. We should never, we should take it as our duty to celebrate. My godbrother Sitapati, he said to me once, Vishnu Jan Swami, very ecstatic devotee in the early days, and then he disappeared somewhere, apparently committed suicide or something. Anyway, sometimes devotees would say, Vishnujan, you're so enthusiastic. It's amazing. He said, no, I'm not always enthusiastic, but I just take it as my duty to chant as statically as I can possibly muster. And that tends to build my enthusiasm. And Sitapati said to me one day, devotees often don't understand this fundamental point. Chanting and dancing is a regulative principle. What does that mean? Whether you feel like it or not, you do it with ecstasy. And then the ecstasy comes. Naturally, because Krishna becomes pleased. And you see that kirtan builds like that. Especially if some devotees are very enthusiastic, other devotees pick up on that. He's like, wow, why am I so mental? Just get into it. So that celebration, very, Krishna conscious, is a transcendental, eternal celebration, a festival. Celebrating the all-attractive Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has nothing to do except enjoy his pastimes, his relationship with his devotees. So I'll end there today and ask if there's any questions or comments. Yes, Prabhu.
Just expanding on that, when I first came over in Melbourne, senior brahmachari came over, you know, sits on a watch to do my service at the temple. And then he says, first thing that you've got to do is you have to be ecstatic. He says, as a temple devotee, your main service is to inspire those people who come to the temple, and you do that by being ecstatic. Even if you're not, you just be ecstatic. And that's, and then you automatically become ecstatic when you do that, because, you know, you cruise around, you've got a big smile on your face, and, you know, someone who's pulling the mental platform comes up and they see you, and then they get happy, and then you get happy.
Yeah.
And then it just this rolling on effect.
Mm.
But that's devotional service, it is ecstatic, and if we're not, then there's something wrong with what we're doing.
It reminds me of a mundane secular story I was listening to the other day. Sometimes I listen to management audio, but it was talking about a, you know, when this guy was working in a grocery store, and he was a runner, and then there was a store across the road, very similar store, and they also had a runner. And at very busy times of the week, like on Saturday, when farmers came into town to buy stuff, you know, things would be selling like hotcakes, and then sometimes, you know, the runner would have to come across to the other store, and say, oh, can we buy 10 cans of tomato paste off you guys so we can sell it to these other guys? So the runner would come across from the other store and run in and buy the things and run off with super enthusiasm. You know, the boss of that store said, wow, that guy must be due for a raise, you know. He's definitely going to get a raise, I said. And the runner of that store said, How do you know? He said, well, if the other guy doesn't give it, I'm going to give it to him. So that's the point, that this enthusiastic energy, even, you know, infinitely more so have we got reason to be enthusiastic in devotional service. And to serve Krishna with an enthusiastic attitude. When we do that, it's amazing, actually. You know, to develop an excellent work ethic in Krishna consciousness is so valuable. And devotees who do that, who just have that, just drive to do their service with excellence and to, you know, put their shoulders to the wheel wherever they can and just be useful and with an enthusiastic spirit, everybody loves those devotees. Everybody appreciates those devotees because they inspire everyone else. So we should all become like that. I like that what you said, you know, the brahmachari said, your first duty is to be ecstatic. But I don't feel ecstatic. Just be ecstatic. Get off the mental platform. So yeah, I think we should write that into our policy, you know. When a new person comes, duty number one. make it into a bureaucratic policy, you know. Any other points? Yeah.
Like you were elaborating on Krishna's quality of being able to expand himself.
Yeah.
And in one sense, it's interesting we can say pure devotee in one sense is also that quality, because like a lot of Prabhupada's disciples, they were saying that they had that feeling that Prabhupada actually was just with them.
Yeah.
They had a very unique relationship
with
Prabhupada.
Yeah, it's true.
So pure devotee also has that ability to actually, you know, expand himself.
Yeah, relate. what was it? Gaga Muni. He was driving on Tamal Krishna Maharaj to just become a new devotee. And he was driving around with Gaga Muni one day. And Gaga Muni was this kind of real melancholy businessman, actually. Quite a cynical person. His favourite story when he'd give Bhagavatam class, we said, talking about Lord Indra becoming a pig because of his excessive sex desire. He became a pig. You know, this was his favourite topic. You just always talk about that. Lord Indra became a pig. He became a hog. Why? Because he was too sexual. You know, too sexually excitable. He became a pig. So this was his kind of mood, you know. And he was driving around with Tamal Krishna Maharaj one day, and he said to Tamal Krishna, you know what? At this time, Tamal Krishna was just a new devotee. He said, you know what? I have only one friend in this world. One friend. That's Prabhupada. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was like, whoa, this movement's heavy, man. But the point is, Prabhupada, you know, even such a person with such a, you know, kind of like a cynical attitude to the world, Prabhupada touched his heart so deeply. So deeply, he considered, you are my only friend, my only true friend. I've noticed that even with my Gurudev, he has that ability to really touch people's heart deeply and make them feel like he really cares about them. And he does that with so many people. And Prabhupada did that with so many people because he is such a personalist. That's what an expert personalist can do. When they see a person, they don't just, you know, they actually really connect. This is another conscious being, a servant of Krishna. And they connect and they appreciate the person on a spiritual level for who they are as an individual. And the person kind of feels that. And is very touched. So the more we become personalist as well, the more that we can have that effect on people. And more than a lot of other things is that relationship. That's what influences people a lot in their road to Krishna consciousness. And even when we are Krishna consciousness, because preaching does not stop until we get back to Godhead. It's not that somebody, you know, puts on a dhoti and puts some tilak on their face, preaching's finished, you know, in the ashram, just leave them to their own devices. No. At every stage of our devotional life, we need guidance, we need encouragement, we need inspiration, and we need to feel the care of especially the senior devotees, but also our peers. Yeah. Very nice point. Any other points? Thank you so much. Gontra Srimad Bhagavatam ki.